It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is a special presentation of the Project Recovery Podcast.
We would kneel together and he'd pray his prayer and I'd pray mine. So this 6 months that I went back to jail turned into the turning point of my life.
The role of faith in recovery. Here are the hosts of the Project Recovery Podcast, Casey Scott and Dr. Matt Woolley on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Hey, welcome to Project Recovery Conference Edition. We're talking about the role of faith in recovery. I'm Casey Scott, and my co-host, as always, the beautiful, the talented, the wonderful Dr. Matt Woolley. So over the course of the next hour, we're going to bring back some of our guests from the podcast talking about the role of faith in recovery. We're going to bring back some of our favorite guests from the past. Dr. Matt, how important do you think the role of faith is in recovery?
Oh, I think it's very important. It sometimes is referred to by different things. We've had so many guests over the last couple of years talk about faith, basically a moment of faith, a moment of inspiration.
Clarity,
spirituality, whether that's tied to religious beliefs specifically or not, as those are the moments, the turning point. Sometimes people say my rock bottom was there and then I had this moment of inspiration and that really headed me in the direction of the recovery that I have today. And so I'm excited for this opportunity to kind of slow down and hone in on, you know, try to highlight one consistent area of recovery that we've found on our show with our guests and just with people that we know, of course, in our regular life. And maybe just to set the stage a little bit for our listeners, the reason we're referring to this as a conference edition, a faith-based edition, is because here in the state of Utah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is prominent, of course, and twice a year they have a worldwide conference where leaders of the church get together and discuss elements of faith. And this being a podcast where, surprisingly, it wasn't our intention, but surprisingly, we've had, or maybe to some people not surprisingly, we've had a lot of people come on, whether they're religious or not, and share moments of faith and inspiration. And so I feel like it's a pivotal point in many of the stories of recovery, and one of the elements that keeps people in recovery is that connection to a higher power, a feeling of inspiration and spirituality.
But I think we need to address the elephant in the room that this can't be the only thing you do for your recovery. You can't pray a disease away. I mean, that's not how this works. At least for me, it's not how it works. I think it's an important part of recovery, but you've got to have other things as well. So we brought in a guy today. His name is Todd Sylvester. He's a counselor at Wasatch Recovery. He's also a life coach, but he's got an amazing story of recovery. As of today, he's celebrating 32 years of sobriety. And he says one of the most instrumental things in his recovery was your faith, was your aha moment. And tell me a little bit about that, Todd.
Yeah, so again, I wasn't raised LDS or religious by any stretch, but it was one of those moments where I reached out to a higher power, to God, and I got a response.
But I think we should probably talk about the experience you had. You'll be able to hear his whole story if you go to our podcast page and download the podcast with Todd Sylvester. But you said after years of partying, you were living in a house that you called the dirty house. You said the outsides matched your insides because you felt dirty inside.
Yeah.
You were actually driving home, contemplating suicide, but for some reason decided to go to the local university where all your buddies hang out. And at this table, there was two missionary girls who sat next to you. And you said, by your own words, over the course of the school year, you gave them nothing but problems.
Yeah. Yeah, I was not nice to these two girls. And this particular day that you're referring to, I'm going home to end my life. And I overhear these two girls talking about fasting and prayer. And for some reason, the word fasting just hit me so hard. I thought, what is that? I honestly didn't know what it was. And so I asked these two girls, as they got up to go to their class, hey, what is that? And they thought I was like going to mock them. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. Like, what is that? And they go on to explain what this is. And as they get done explaining it to it, I said, well, you know, in my point, I'm going, what's the point? And they said, if you want help from God. And for the first time, I thought, is there a God and would he help me? And so I decided at that point, I'm going to go and do that.
Now, so you started the morning on your knees praying to God, and then you began your fast. You said it was harder than you had imagined.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. First time I woke up without, you know, popping a pill or smoking anything or having a drink. And I, you know, you're not supposed to eat or drink during a fast. That's what fast means, right?
Yeah.
I made it till about noon and the girls told me to end the fast with a prayer. So I did that as well. I ended with a prayer saying, God, I did this fast. And if you're there, I need help.
Did he?
Yeah. Not immediately. No, nothing happened in that moment. I thought, wow, what, you know, I'm an infant in this. I don't know what's going on. And nothing happened in that moment. And it wasn't until about a month later, I got a phone call from a good friend of mine that I played basketball with. Hadn't talked to him since high school. It's been several years. He calls me up and says, I need to talk to you today. I go over to his place. We sit down just like we're sitting here. And he just starts saying all these good things about me. And at this point, I'm a mess in my life and the addictions, I'm at the height of it and I'm doing all these horrible things. And as he's saying these nice things, I stop him because it makes me uncomfortable. I said, "What? Why are you saying these things?" You know, and he goes, Todd, I didn't go to work today because there's a message I need to share with you. And I'm like, what's going on? And I can tell he's nervous to say something. Long pause, takes a deep breath, and he just says, hey, the Lord came to me last night and says, we need you on our side today. And when that happened, I knew that that was an answer to the fast and prayer.
That's an answer.
Yeah.
So throughout this episode, we're going to be talking about the role of faith in recovery. We're going to bring back some of our favorite guests from the past and talk about their aha moments. We're going to talk about it with Dr. Matt and Todd. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Role of Faith in Recovery. Hear more of Casey Scott and Dr. Matt Woolley on Project Recovery, wherever you find great podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery Conference Edition. Today, we're talking about the role of faith in recovery. What does that mean? That means myself, Casey Scott, and Dr. Matt Woolley, and our guest, Todd Sylvester, today are going to talk about some of our past guests when they had their moments of clarity, when they had their spiritual enlightenment, whatever they found to help them get on the road to recovery. My first question is to Dr. Matt. Dr. Matt, how important do you think faith is when it comes to recovery?
Well, faith or moments of clarity, spirituality, inspiration are a common theme over the last several years of our show in interviewing people, individuals who maybe are religious or have no religious experience in their life have expressed that moment of faith, that moment of inspiration is the catalyst to change for them. And it's a powerful moment. I think sometimes we try to think our way through problems and we use rational thinking, which is very helpful. But it's these emotional, spiritual, powerful catalyst moments that really, I think, send people down that road to recovery. And I think you and I have both sometimes been left speechless listening to some of those moments where a person shares how a moment of faithful inspiration really changed their whole perspective on life and themselves and motivated them to seek recovery.
Todd, a couple years back, we had Christian Smith on the podcast, and you know him.
Yes.
He holds the record for most swears on our podcast, but this is his aha moment. Listen to this.
the monkeys in my head hold a committee meeting. And one of them suggests, you know, you got $40 and you're pretty stressed. Maybe instead of going down to the courthouse right now, you just go downtown for a minute, alleviate that stress, and then go to the courthouse. So we take a vote, and I'm certain it was unanimous, the monkeys. So I'm now driving around Pioneer Park because I know that gig back in the day, you didn't have to get your car. Meet Ice with somebody who's going to do what we need. The phone rings again. It's my counselor, Jason Webb, my counselor and dear friend now. I listen to his voicemails. The first couple were, hey, this is Jason. I'm concerned about you. Call me. It crescendoed to the middle of the week to about as assertive, as aggressive as he can get. Hey, this is ridiculous. But he's an LDS guy that doesn't say that. So he's, this is ridiculous. Call me. But the last message he left was the message that saved my life and the final catalytic event. This is the message he left. Christian, it's Jason. Have I told you I love you lately? That message gave me enough courage to pick up the phone and say, I'm not in a good place. Not fear of reprisal and judgment. I'm just not in a good place. He just opened that door by saying, I'm not judging you, brother. I just love you. And so I called him and I went back for 30 more days. And that was February 4th, 2010. During that time, my brain lights went on where I figured out it never worked for me. That was supposed to be $40. In an hour or so, turned into 10 days. And I had looked back and looked back and looked back. Not one time did it ever work. And so my brain light went on and said, maybe you ought to just figure a different way, brother. And I made a commitment that day. I'm not doing it anymore. I married a woman who's a strong personality. I got four kids. Now we got 5.5 grandkids. I got a lot of stress in my life. But I made the commitment. I'm not picking up. So we communicate better. Kelly, I say stuff like, Kelly, did you purposely try to offend me with what you just said? And she goes, no, what are you talking about? We don't mind read anymore. We spend more quality time. I'm more open, honest. The gifts of recovery for me have been, I thought this God I knew as a kid was loved me contingent upon my doing all the things all the time. Right. And if I wasn't, then out of the pool. Smith, get the hell out of the pool. You're out of the pool. When the God I understand now that was given to me through recovery and 12 steps and AA, the God I know now says this. And the light bulb went on some years early into recovery when I'm still not sure about it. A guy says, Smith, you got this problem with God. You have four kids. Is there anything your kids could do to stop you from loving them? And I thought, no. He said, you sure? And so I thought, well, I've raised four teenagers and Sarah is a pain in the butt. But no, there's nothing. I'm familiar with frustration and disappointment, but nothing they could do to stop me from loving them. No. And then he said the magic words. Do you think God could feel that way about God's kids? And I'm going, holy cow. That feels like that might be true. And if it is true, I could have a relationship with that God. You mean you're just going to love me because I'm your kid, not because I do or don't do anything?
Unconditional.
Unconditional love. First time I felt it.
You know, Todd, the thing about that clip is the three simple words, I love you, meant the world to Christian. What are your takes on that?
You know, there's a beautiful scripture that goes along with that. 1 John 4:8, it says, he that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. And just hearing those things, I mean, it's like what we're yearning for, especially when we're in addiction. We feel like no one loves us. We don't even love ourselves. And so to hear those powerful words, I mean, there's power in a word, right? And so him hearing that, I mean, I had the chills just hearing how he described that. And I think it's, you know, that's a very powerful thing. I think that's when we feel God in our lives is when we feel love.
Now, you work as a counselor at a recovery center here in Utah, and I'm sure you sit down with people all the time that say, I'm not going to do 12-step because I don't believe in God. Yeah. I don't do this, and I don't do that. What do you say to somebody who's not ready to hear a message? You know, I mean, how do you get through to them?
Oh, I love this question. I get it all the time. What I say to them, I read in a book a line that just changed my life. God doesn't have love. God is love. So I always look at that person. Can we agree? Can we use the word love for a second? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, yeah. And I say, when my 4-year-old granddaughter walks into the room, guess what the whole room feels? They go, love. And I go, why? Because she's love. Okay, if she's love, that means you're love and so am I. How does love connect with love? You give away love. And I go, so in those moments, that's when you connect with your higher power, is when I do something nice for you. You do something nice for someone. You feel love, they felt love, or in other words, you just connected with God.
And you're listening to Project Recovery, and throughout the rest of the program, once again, we're talking about the role of faith in recovery. You're listening to Project Recovery right here on KSL.
This is a special presentation of the Project Recovery Podcast.
We would kneel together and he'd pray his prayer and I'd pray mine. So this 6 months that I went back to jail turned into the turning point of my life.
The role of faith in recovery. Here are the hosts of the Project Recovery Podcast, Casey Scott and Dr. Matt Woolley on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Welcome back to Project Recovery Conference Edition. Today we're talking about the role in faith in recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That is Dr. Matt Woolley. We're also having Todd Sylvester sitting with us, and he's kind of going some of our past guests and kind of where their faith began and got them on their road to recovery. Now, Dr. Matt, we're going to talk about an old-time friend, Dr. Rod Gardner. And do you remember Rod Gardner?
Love Rod. Love Rod. Really, really powerful story.
He was a dentist and an oral surgeon, I believe, and found himself in a bad way.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I think Rod's story is one of those that sort of clued us into the fact that we're seeing this pattern over and over again in our guests of people having these powerful spiritual moments at a point in life where you and I usually refer to it as rock bottom. They're about as low as they can get. And Rod's story, just to kind of refresh everyone or to set it up for people who haven't heard it yet, you know, Rod was an esteemed member of his community, small town in northern Utah. He's a dentist that everyone goes and sees and works with. And he's a very personable guy. But because of his addiction to opioids, he started breaking the law. He started stealing and writing false prescriptions and eventually, lost his license and committed federal crimes. So this isn't just, you know, slap your wrist and, you know, you have to take a break from work, but he lost everything and ended up in federal prison.
And this is where we hear from Rod.
We were in 23-hour lockdown for 2 months. So you ate in your cell, you everything. You get to come out for 1 hour to take a shower. If somebody did something wrong in the tier, you didn't get a break. You could be in your cell for 3, 4, 5 days at a time.
Wow.
And I'm down there with nothing to deal with my anxiety. So it's through the roof. I'm not sleeping. I can't even explain how bad it is. Anyone who's gone to prison and survives it and comes out and is anywhere near a contributing member of society, I have a ton of respect for them. I've been bouncing off the bottom for a long time. They threw me out of the church, excommunicated me from the church. And I just remember laying in this cell back in Cache County thinking, you know, sometimes when you're in a really bad situation, you can think of one good thing. It's like, okay, I'm going to focus on that one good thing. There was nothing. And they brought the razors in one night. And they count the razors, you know, when they bring them in and take them out. And I took one of them and I busted it up and I got the blade out of it and flushed all the plastic down the toilet, stuck it in the bottom of my shoe. And I just didn't know. I didn't see any way out. I wasn't a member of the church anymore. So God didn't like, you know, I was alone. And going back to prison terrified me. And I knew that's where I was going. And I'd take my towel and wrap it around my head to block out the light and the noise. And I just lay on my bunk. And I remember just laying there trying to say a prayer and just I'd get a little ways into it. And I just couldn't even pray. I was so wound up. But after weeks of trying, I finally started to find some peace. I was in the cell with about 30 guys. It's like triple bunks, and the jail commander decided to offer me a job in the kitchen. So they pulled me out of there and they put me in a cell with 5 other guys. And I was starting to meditate, and forced meditation really works. You know, it's hard now that I'm out in life, but it's amazing what you can do when you're backs against the wall, and I started to find peace and meditation and prayer, and that's all I wanted to do. And when I got in this cell with these other five guys, I had this longing to kneel down and pray. But I didn't know how it was going to go over, you know. But one night I decided, okay, the lights go dim. They never go dark in jail. They got to be able to watch you. So the lights go dim, and I kneel down and say a prayer. And I just kept doing that every morning and every night for a while. And I don't know how long it was, but one night I kneel down and I start to pray, and I feel my bunk move next to me. And I look out the corner of my eye, and this other inmate's kneeling next to me. And I remember thanking God that I was there. I remember being so full of gratitude that I was there. And before I finished my prayer, he hopped up and got back in his bed. But the next day, he grabs me. He's all, "Hey, Doc, I knelt down by you last night, but I don't know how to pray. Will you teach me how to pray?" And so I go back to my missionary days, and I teach him the steps of prayer. And then he and I start praying together every night, you know, not out loud, but we would kneel together, and he'd pray his prayer and I'd pray mine. And eventually another guy joined us. So this 6 months that I went back to jail turned into the turning point of my life. And my sponsor told me all along that one day, if you get through this, you will look at all this horrible stuff as the greatest blessing of your life. And that's what it became.
That is such an emotional story. Dr. Matt, I mean, I got chills just re-listening to that. I think the power of prayer is amazing. Dr. Matt, over the 3 years that we have done this podcast, we have probably had a dozen or so people who said that was the first time that they ever really prayed. And I think there's something to that, that they have tried everything else. And so they says, what do I have to lose? So I'm going to get down on bended knee. I'm going to look towards the heaven, and I'm going to ask for help. I think there is a real power in prayer. Would you agree, Dr. Matt?
Oh, for sure. We've had a lot of great stories about people talking about whether they were trained as a child to know how to pray or they had never been trained how to pray, that in a moment I would throw in the word humility. Often a person I know feels like they're at their rock bottom and they're reaching out for that connection, and prayer is a way that people have always tried to make that connection to a higher power. And the thing I noticed that's one of the common factors for people, whether it's Rod's story or our guest today, Todd's story, is the humility in asking for help.
When you bent down on your knees to pray to God in that closet in the dirty house,
yeah,
what were you hoping for?
You know, I was hoping for an answer to my suffering. I wanted the suffering to stop.
And before that, had you ever prayed before?
No. I knew what prayer was, but like, you know, this was the first time that I could ever remember that it was sincerely like I was desperate and I needed help. And so, yeah, that was one of those moments that I was looking for the end of my suffering.
But prayer was kind of a reoccurring thing in your recovery.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the story of you and a little lemonade girl.
Yeah, so I'm a bartender, and I'd get tips from the waiters and waitresses and anyone at the bar, and I'd keep the change in the cup holders of my car. And this particular day that you're referring to, Casey, is I'm driving out of my neighborhood, and I see this little girl out of the corner of my eye selling lemonade. I just drive right on past, don't think anything of it, and then I had this impression, right? You can call it the spirit, said, "Hey, turn around and give her all the money in your car." I thought, wow, that'll be awesome. So I turn my car around. And I pull up to this cute little girl, and she's selling lemonade. And I said, "How much for a cup of lemonade?" She said, "25 cents. I'll take one." She pours it. I put it on my dashboard, and I tell her to cup her hands in front of her like this. And I just start scooping all this money into her hand, and she's freaking out. And her reaction's like tattooed on my brain. And I'm still, it takes me like 10 scoops to get all this money to her. And the last scoop she throws on the table and takes off into the house. And I'm thinking she's going to go tell her parents some dude just gave her $1 million, right? And as I pull away, I start to cry like I've never cried before in my entire life. Because for the first time I could ever remember, I actually made someone's day. Because, you know, in addiction, we become the most selfish people on the planet.
Master manipulators.
Absolutely.
Doing whatever we can to feed our addict.
And I cried. It was one of those soul cleansing cries. And as I was crying in those in that moment, I felt like I mattered. I loved who I was. I wanted to be clean and sober. I wanted to do the right thing. And it was that was the beginning of me changing my life. And listening to that impression was everything. And it is amazing. I gave all my money to this girl and I got my life back.
But you not only did it that one time, you did it a couple other times.
Yeah, I did it for the next every Saturday for the next 2.5 months. And so and every time I'd pull up, she would just be like, oh my gosh, here's the guy again, right? Like she was like looking at me like, how much money's gonna give me today? And I just keep doing this.
So after that you decide, hey, I'm gonna give this church thing a shot.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in the back row of the LDS church.
Yep. I'm in back there and thinking I'll stay for a few minutes, but I look on the other side of the chapel and there's that little lemonade girl with her mom and she sees me and recognizes me and starts waving and telling her mom, there's the guy right there, you know? And so I end up staying for the entire
service.
And as they start to walk over towards me, my heart's pounding. I'm like, what's going on here? And the mom's crying and she comes up and gives me this big hug. She's in my ear and she says, thank you so much for what you've done for my daughter. And I said, no, you have no idea what this has done for me. It's changed my life. I'm like, I want to, you know, I was on fire, right? And she said, well, we have a favor to ask you. And then that's when they invited me to take her to a daddy-daughter date.
Because her dad wasn't there. And then you find yourself at that dinner doing a prayer.
Doing a prayer. They're blessing the hot dogs and Kool-Aid, which I thought was strange because, again, I'm an infant in the whole thing. And during this prayer, I hear a voice in my head that says, Todd, you're in the right place doing the right thing, and you made an impact on this girl's life she'll never forget, and I lose it. And it was in that moment that I knew I was done.
We're talking about the power of prayer. We're also talking about the role of faith in recovery. And that's pretty amazing to have that kind of reaction. Let me ask you now, do you pray all the time?
Yeah. I try to pray every day. I'm sure I miss a few days, I've always utilized prayer in my recovery for the last 30 years.
Now, Dr. Matt, you're also into meditation. Some would say that meditation is kind of like praying. Would you not? Do you agree?
I would say it's kind of like praying. Sure. I think, it's a moment of stillness and introspection and calmness. But I would say prayer is a little different in the sense that, prayer is an act of humility. And if there's one thing that a person is not, usually when they're in their active addiction, it's not humble. Like you've said, master manipulator and just doing all the selfish things that you can do. And I think that's one of the specifically important differences about prayer is that prayer is an act of humility where you literally are humbling yourself and asking for a higher power to help and guide you.
I love it. Hey, you're listening to Project Recovery Conference Edition right here on KSL. We're talking about the role of faith in recovery. Coming up, we've got more. We'll listen to Rob Eastman's story right here on KSL.
You're listening to the role of faith in recovery. Hear more of Casey Scott and Dr. Matt Woolley on Project Recovery, wherever you find great podcasts.
Welcome back to Project Recovery Conference Edition. Today we're talking about the role of faith in recovery. I am Casey Scott. My co-host is Dr. Matt Woolley. We're joined by Todd Sylvester, and we're kind of going over some of the past guests and their aha moments. Now, Todd, the thing about addiction is it makes you do things you normally wouldn't do. People say, why would you do that? Right. And the reality is that the addict brain is taking over, and it's doing what it needs to get what it wants. Mm-hmm. We find ourselves listening to Rob Eastman right now. He just found out he was a father. He's in the delivering room, and all he can think about is doing drugs in the bathroom. But it all comes to light when he asks for help. Listen to this.
And anytime I felt anxiety, I would have to get high, right? So I'm in the delivery room, in the bathroom, trying to shoot up. I can't find the vein. And I hear everything's getting closer to being born. And then I finally get it, and I walked out as they were pulling my daughter out. they got her breathing and they wrapped her up and I'm holding her for a second and my family wants me to come out. And so I went out there long enough to show my family. And then I went back in, I gave her to my wife and I went to my drug dealer's house. It got to the point where I couldn't go to work. So my job was to stay home and take care of the baby while my wife, who just had a baby, had to go to work. And that turned into me taking the diaper and food money and going buying dope. That thought process keeps coming through my head about suicide. Like, if I accidentally overdose, that's not a suicide. So I went out and I put 8 balloons in a spoon and drew it up, and that's enough to kill this entire room and probably 3 more down the street. And I shot up, and in my head, the worst thing happened. Woke up the next day. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, man, I can't even kill myself right. And my dad came around and sat across from me and handed me a piece of paper. And he said, read it. And I was like, what is it? He's like, just read it. And I started reading it, and it was my obituary. All I had was my car, and I went and sat down, and I slept in my car down by Pioneer Park for about 3 days. And my ego was still so big at that point that I wasn't going to be homeless. And the only way I could see my daughter is if I had supervised visitation, which gave me an in to get into my parents' house to get a gun. So I went up, kissed my daughter, went to the bathroom when really I went in and snuck in and got a gun, and went, gave my mom a hug, gave my dad a hug. And so I went up above the Bountiful Temple. There's some benches up there that overlook the temple on the mountain above it. And I knelt down and I put the gun in my mouth and I started pulling the trigger. And these visions of my mom and my daughter popped into my head. And my mom, she's a pretty religious lady, and she loved God so much, and I absolutely hated him. And I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pray to her God so that when he doesn't answer my prayer, that when she dies, she can go look him in his face and say, you failed me. So I knelt down, and I said a little prayer. I said, I don't know anything about a still small voice. I'm going to need something a little bit louder than that. And if I open my eyes and I don't get a sign, I'm going to pull the trigger. And right as I went to open my eyes, this is August 31st, 2009, a firework display went off above the temple. And I was sitting there like, is this the freaking sign? And shortly after that, I heard a voice that said, is that loud enough? And I don't know if that was in my subconscious or if I actually heard it or what, but I was paralyzed. And I laid there bawling for about 25 minutes and I couldn't move. Got up, drove down to my parents' house, told them what had happened. I drove myself straight to LDS Hospital, checked into detox, and went to Renaissance Ranch.
And as of today, he's 13 years sober. That's a powerful story, talking about faith and recovery. Dr. Matt, I remember listening to that the first time and thinking, wow, maybe that's how God works. He asked and he got it. But that's not always how it works, right?
No, it isn't. I was listening to that again, still trying to think of what holiday it is on August 10th, you know, where you'd have fireworks going off.
I thought the same thing. And that's what makes it even more mystical, is maybe it was just somebody doing random fireworks, but it was a message, and it meant the world to him, and it set him on his road to recovery.
It did, and I guess my thought is, and I love Rob, and I really appreciate all that he does for everyone, and I love that there are people like Rob that have those stories to tell, because they really are inspirational. To the average listener, though, maybe to people who've knelt down and prayed and not seen fireworks or heard a voice, I think it's important to realize that, the reaching out for a higher power, feeling spirituality in your life, accepting guidance and utilizing the power of prayer isn't always something that other people would recognize. Most of the time, it's something that's very personal. And it is sometimes a still small voice or a small impression that a person feels. Again, I think it comes back to when a person gets to the point that they really, really desperately need that connection in order to move forward with life.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think we want complexity. I think we as human beings, we try to overcomplicate this whole thing, and that gets us stuck. And I think sometimes it's fireworks, and sometimes, like what Dr. Matt was saying, sometimes it's a word that someone said to you, or it's a feeling or an impression. But we do, we quickly discount it and say, no, it's got to be something more than that. But in reality, it's actually pretty simple. But yet we want to overcomplicate it and then discount, oh, well, the fireworks, that was a fluke. But actually, no, look what it did. Like, look how long he's been clean now. He's doing amazing. I love it.
And the thing that I've really loved about this episode of Role of Faith in Recovery is that it comes in grand ways. It comes in simple ways. It comes in soft ways. But it is there. I think we need to be in tune with ourselves, ask ourselves what we want, look to our higher power, and ask for help. And if you listen, help is there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so thank you very much for sitting with us this week here on Project Recovery Conference Edition, talking about the role of faith in recovery. Dr. Matt, is there any takeaways from this episode that you could leave the people with?
Well, you know, I think it's one of our themes, Casey, and that is that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. It's what?
Connection.
And today we're talking about connection, you know, on just what we normally talk about, but connection with our faith, with spirituality, with a higher power, with the tools of things like prayer and fasting, as demonstrated by Todd's wonderful story. And so I would say if you're feeling low today, if you're struggling with addiction or someone in your family is, think in terms of connection. Connection will, I think, guide you in the right direction.
We want to thank our guest, Todd Sylvester, for stopping by today. If people want to find out more information about you and what you offer, where do they go?
Then go to my website, toddinspires.com.
And you can get all the information you need about Todd. I love you. I mean it. Thank you for stopping by and listening to this special edition of Project Recovery for Conference Weekend. Be good out there. Love one another. And don't forget, Project Recovery is a KSL podcast.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.